From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Within a 24-hour period, environmental activists saw not one, not two, but three major oil and gas pipelines facing serious obstacles. The Keystone XL pipeline, a transatlantic project bringing tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada to the U.S. Gulf Coast, is lacking a critical permit that the U.S. Supreme Court has now refused to intervene in, leaving a lower court ruling in place against the permit. Another court has ordered the shutdown of the Dakota Access Pipeline project, which cuts through South Dakota and a number of other states, and which was the focus of sustained protests in 2016 at Standing Rock. A third, lesser-known project called the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was cancelled altogether. My guest is Tamara Tolles O'Loughlin. She is the North America Director of 350.org. Welcome to the program, Tamara.
Thank you for having me. So glad to be here.
So let's talk about these projects one after the other. I want to start with the Keystone XL pipeline, which was sort of before the Dakota Access Pipeline became famous, was the major project that organizations like yours, that environmentalists around the country had been united against and fought a sustained battle against during the Obama administration. And then right before Obama left office, he canceled the Keystone pipeline. That got reversed under Trump. How significant is the Supreme Court decision on this pipeline project, and what does it mean for the project?
Sure. So Keystone XL has been a 12-year fight. This organization is a part of that long-term story of what Dallas Goldtooth calls the zombie pipeline. And for all intents and purposes, today's permit win gives a reprieve to this particularly evil form of the work, because tribal nations, farmers, ranchers, and communities on along the route have been fighting it mercilessly, despite the pleas against the Trump administration working so hard to revive it. We have stayed on them about construction after a lower court revoked the water crossing permit. That pipeline is facing multiple lawsuits from tribal nations and local and national organizations. And TC Energy, the folks behind it, do not have all the permits needed to complete it. So given that we have been involved in this work for a while, getting up to 48,000 people to sign a promise to get into the streets and fight for this and our promise to protect, it's really huge that we have gotten to a place where the water crossing permit here stops the action from continuing, largely because there are other permits. And some of what we are concerned about as a win today opens up work for 70 other pipelines. So it's blocked for now, but the Supreme Court ruling opens up 70 smaller actions that our communities will have to fight along the pathway. So we're breathing a sigh of relief about this monster, hoping that we get delays that force a new president in the next election to kill this beast for good. But we are keeping our eyes on the 70 other pipelines that are endangered.
Wow, 70 other pipelines. I was not even aware of that. How far along is the Keystone XL pipeline? And has it not already shown to have had precisely the kind of leaks that activists have warned against?
Yeah, it poses a number of challenges that we're concerned about. Yeah, pipes do two things, deliver products and leak. So if it's not doing one, it's doing the other. And sometimes it's doing them both at the same time. So that's a thing that we're concerned about. Following on from that, the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline in a period of climate and COVID crisis means bringing in folks from across the world, across various jurisdictions, and ramping up the threat of COVID to do any work on it. So as we are thinking about what the climate impacts are, continuing to like shovel money, good money after bad money to prop up stuff that will only push us past our climate targets, we're also worried about people's health and safety. Communities are shutting down. Ranching communities, Native American tribal and indigenous communities have shut down their borders to protect their communities from being ravaged by COVID. And any perception that doing anything other than shutting down Keystone XL pipeline will not make that threat go away. So we need it to go away for good. We're super excited about this crucial permit rejection and the idea that the federal court is holding up rejection of the pipeline to give us more time. But these other things that we're concerned about are not a complete victory.
Let's talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline. This was a project that became very well known, made national and international headlines, precisely because an indigenous-led movement at Standing Rock in South Dakota 4 years ago began in what started out as a small occupation of the area and then a massive movement that brought together different sorts of environmental activists from around the country. This was a very powerful, very moving moment in the history of environmental activism against fossil fuels. And then we saw the Electoral College win of Donald Trump, and he basically signed off on the Dakota Access Pipeline project. So what is the current status of that project as part of this slate of three back-to-back victories this week?
Sure. So as you pointed out, Native-led resistance to Dakota Access and Keystone really push for global solidarity actions. Dakota Access is the game changer for resistance and really help people to understand that this is a necessary tactic to protect our communities. Thousands of people from North Dakota, the Cheyenne River Sioux tribes, brought resistance to everyone's doorstep and really showed us that greedy corporations like Energy Transfer Partners are claiming rights to stolen land. The idea that any decision rendered by the court to halt this kind of work comes on the hands of there are a lot of folks who can take credit for getting us to this moment: tribes, ranchers, communities who have fought for themselves. But also, there's a rare moment where political actors got in the fray on the right side. Chairman Grijalva led a bicameral amicus brief that brought in 36 folks from the House and Senate to say that 1,200 miles of Dakota Access Pipeline would be unlawful, push us over our limits, and was not in support by the legislative branch. So I think we're in a unique moment where the courts are halting continued work on these pipelines. And the legislative branch is where they normally throw this thing. If you haven't decided in the court, then they wonder what's happening in the legislature, has also said this is a big no. So for all intents and purposes, it's us against the executive, which is huge.
So what is the fate currently of the Dakota Access Pipeline project? Is it canceled or could it be revived?
Well, the idea of things being canceled is a long, the idea that we're going to be able to cancel a pipeline is a thing that is all about the political calculus. So we can stop something from happening because of a permit. We can organize real fights against continued operations. We can push back because these things can always be revived by another permit, by a court opinion. Mm-hmm. In this case, add the judge demanding that barrels of oil get drained from a process already en route. This is why Dakota Access and Keystone XL are really pivotal moments in the conversation, because saying you can't leverage and destroy endangered species, you cannot continue to pump your filthy product when NEPA has been violated, because the very idea of it is that before actions are taken that can cause harm, the environment impacts are reviewed by the government. The fact that NEPA has been upheld in a period where 45's administration is rolling it back, he wants us to get in before up to our necks before we can even determine what's happened to us. And so the court stepping in here to say, wrong move, wrong decision, we're not taking that, is huge.
And then there's the Atlantic Coast Pipeline project, has faced protest like the other projects have. I'm not sure exactly what it was that led to its, what seems like cancellation, or maybe it's just postponement, but cost overruns had something to do with it?
Yeah, so 3.5 years of organizing. So the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is very near and dear to me. I live in Baltimore, and the DC, Maryland, and Virginia communities that stepped in line in support of holding this up, it's been a valiant effort over many communities organizing locally. 3.5 years and a ballooning budget means it's no longer affordable. So this is another place where the National Environmental Policy Act really was the line in the sand that says you have to determine what harm you're going to take. And Black and Native leaders fought together heartily, along with a network of environmental and climate activists, to take on Dominion Energy and Duke Energy. Dominion is the author of of climate change impacts. For anyone who's paying attention, running the largest import-export terminal out of a sleepy town community here in Maryland forever and closing down those folks' ability to get out of the climate fight. So as the stakes of the climate crisis go up, our willingness to take bold action is really paying off. And it is nothing but congratulations and gratitude for those individual local communities that took this fight up over and over again until it was proven to be too expensive as the bottom starts to fall out of coal, oil, and gas.
Right. The issue of fossil fuels is such an interesting one because there's a lot of economic factors that play into this. And some have pointed out that the cancellation of the Atlantic pipeline means a win for coal. That's what Forbes, that's how Forbes.com pointed it out. Atlantic Coast Pipeline canceled, coal wins. There is a glut of particularly shale oil and gas in the United States because fracking, the practice of hydraulic fracturing, unleashed so much of this energy source into the market. And then, of course, this past year with the coronavirus and the halting of, you know, a lot of transportation for many months also caused the bottom to fall out of the fossil fuel industry, economically speaking. So was this cancellation more due to the fact that the economy has made this just less lucrative for these companies?
So I'd say it's death by a thousand cuts this time for both and thinking. Communities that have been attacked from many different sides, feeling cumulative impacts, pushing for a just recovery that looks at the harm through lots of different lenses would say that it's justice well earned because the fact that it is no longer an affordable business model, it is not a safe practice to put your money in coal, oil, and gas. The infrastructure itself is worthless and the crude oil pumping through it doesn't have a market. I think that these are lessons that should be pushing us to continue investments in jobs, infrastructure, and human health built on a new economy, a green economy. As long as the sun shines and the wind blows, there's an endless amount of clean energy that we can be investing in. And so the fact that a financial blow is as toxic as a lack of social license, those two things coming together was always going to happen. And so we're just here to look over it and make sure that the managed decline happens sooner than we are managed as a species to decline.
We know that the fossil fuel industry receives massive government subsidies. We know that some fossil fuel companies got paycheck protection program loans, these were taxpayer-backed loans. And President Trump made it very clear that he wasn't going to let the industry die. Are you worried that the government, under Trump especially, and possibly a future president, would just throw enough money at these companies because they have this ideological attachment to keeping fossil fuels going as an industry?
So I wish it was an ideological attachment. That would make me feel like we're in a fight with people who just think things are different. The science is true in every direction. The projections around our ability to withstand continued investments are clear information. The attachment is to making money hand over fist, of crushing people and being able to own the government. So I think sustaining themselves by continuing to create backdoor deals that take all of the people's common good, common wealth, common resources, and push it in the hands of a small group of people is not about ideology. It's about greed. And I would hate to cast the guy from Queens as a lifelong Brooklynite, as someone who actually, the guy from Queens living in the White House is only here to make money. And he will make money by draining the government, destroying the democracy, continuing to pump up fossil fuels until they drop dead and then are resurrected as green energy projects funded with that same money. So I think part of why we're focused on a just recovery and are pushing for a people's bailout that doesn't shortchange us without any actual protections for communities that are hurt first and worst is because we already know the transition is happening. And that's not a secret information. It's not proprietary. Oil and gas, coal folks know this as well. What they're doing is trying to set themselves up so that the next version of us paying into them is a green scheme funded by all their dirty business.
Tamara, what is next specifically around these pipeline projects that we've been discussing, setting aside the broader long-term goal of, some sort of Green New Deal type future? What is being done or what needs to be done to ensure that the Keystone pipeline project, the Dakota Access Pipeline project, remain, in limbo, are not finished? It is not clear, unfortunately, that a Joe Biden presidency would ensure that these projects, stay unfinished. It took so much work to get the liberal Democrat Barack Obama to take stands against these projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the Obama presidency is that we had more time. We had time for political gamesmanship and moving of different kinds of policy models and figuring out whose back needed to be scratched. We don't have that kind of time now. Biden has been very smart in saying that Keystone XL won't see to the light of day under his administration, and we heartily applaud that because Trump's agenda to support his friends can't continue under a new administration as they make new friends. The only right response would be for him to stop it forever, to call the question and move through the election year, committing to all the related policies that would push us there. So for the next few months, all we're focused on is what a climate president has to look like and pushing for the Biden campaign to be in alignment with that. We're looking for a climate ambition, investment in communities and jobs, infrastructure and human health, and environmental justice commitments that show up in people and resources moving into urban and rural space to help people that have been hurt. Those are things that are real, that have to happen now, that will be declared at various conventions and lots of the debate. But everything we have to lose is bound up in whether or not we have an aggressive climate action plan.
Right. Oh, I had not heard of Biden taking a position specifically against Keystone on the Dakota Access Pipeline, in particular the environmental review that needs to be completed. Is that something that you think the companies that are leading this project are going to be able to overcome?
So, an environmental impact assessment, which comes to us by way of the National Environmental Policy Act, has been the
This is
only thing
NEPA
that.
that you've been referring to earlier as well.
It's the only thing that's ever given communities a chance to be made visible in this process. An environmental impact assessment looks at harms to species, to water, to resources, and creates the only inflection point when you're building a business case for why you want to do something. There are other measurements which would help, from health impact assessments, which actually look at the health of communities and people surrounding these things. There are a number of tools. The EIS is a gateway to a good set of measurements, but we need to push for that process because in this moment, there's no way that any of these pipelines could succeed on a level measurement of whether or not harm to water, which cannot be saved once it's degraded, of species that are lost once we cross those lines, of growing patterns and ecological systems that depend on very specific nutrient balances, and having all of those things be ripped up because we're not taking the appropriate measurements, it would be a farce. And given how much work has been put in to pushing for an environmental impact assessment, we have no doubt that the information it would turn up would be damning for coal, oil, and gas interests.
Are you worried that considering the multiple, challenges, if you will, facing Americans, especially in the first half of this year, that are not likely to go away, specifically with the pandemic, the economic collapse, and of course, ongoing racist police violence, that all of these things might be taking the wind out of the sails of the environmental movement at a very critical time, because of course the earth isn't going to, the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide emissions aren't necessarily disappearing or going away once things are, businesses are going back to normal, quote unquote. All of those pauses we saw in emissions will come roaring back. Or can there be a strong case made linking all of these issues together in people's minds?
My gosh. So we just recently, I put out an op-ed called "If You Want to Protect the Environment, You Have to Dismantle White Supremacy." As a Black climate activist, a lifelong environmentalist who happens to be Black all day, every day here in America, I can tell you that there are incredible links because our people care about stewardship. They have been the original caretakers of this land, hand in hand with indigenous communities, and subject to the same horrifying fates over and over again. It does feel like we're in a moment where you can't see it because there's a screen behind me, but the wind is behind our backs on this one. Our goal in climate work, in order for it to be successful, is that we had to broaden the movement. We have to have enough people looking at the problem in order to make change. The concerns we have are not of complicated systems, but of enough political will to push people who are taking our money and our power and doing things we don't want with it. And so having a conversation about how racism makes climate impacts more likely in a system that is designed to damage and destroy the same communities means we only have a larger group of people looking at these facts. Part of why we've seen week after week after week of people getting into the streets is because there are no more excuses. And the unfortunate truth of the compound crisis of climate and COVID is that it has the same author. Poor health happens to plenty of people, but poor health by design is what's happening in America. And there are no harms for COVID that weren't laid by fossil fuel damage to people's air, water, and livelihood. So I would say that the two things have always been on the same trajectory and are finally aligning in a way that allows us to work better together as progressives.
Where can people read this piece that you just mentioned that you wrote?
Sure, it's on Grist. It's called. It has a really cool graphic called "Divest from Fossil Fuels, Defund the Police," and it is an incredible opportunity to really start to think about the fact that our ongoing fight for divestment over the last 10 years matches exactly the call of defund the police by the Movement for Black Lives. Because guess what? We are in a moment where ending the reign of things that hurt us to invest those same dollar and resources in the things that help us. That's as true whether we're talking about taking out the dollars from coal, oil, and gas, or removing subsidies for police forces who attack local citizens. So we're looking for a divestment across the board so that we can reinvest in people.
And we will find that article and post a link to it from our website. Finally, Tamara, we are in an election year. It's not just a presidential election. There are a number of course, House seats that are always up for election. The U.S. Senate and its control by whichever party is up as well. It's up in the air. We have seen the power of even a small handful of vocal progressives getting into the halls of power, into Congress, can make a difference. You know, young people, particularly like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar, and then, of course, progressive stalwarts that have been there for a long time. How important do you think this election is also to these issues that we've just been discussing?
My gosh, it feels like the most important election of anyone's lifetime. Mm. It's easy to say that because we're here now, but given that we're in what Bill McKibben calls the time test for climate, the clock is only going counting down. We need an administration that is responsive to our issues, that's supported by a Congress that pushes through bold action. Wherever the branches meet, we're able to make things happen. And we need climate champions in every seat, in every house, regardless of what their political ideologies might be, because the climate isn't gonna sort us by our political affiliation. And so the down ballot seats mean as much to us as the top of the ticket, because at the end of the day, you have to have allies across the work. As you mentioned, there are folks who have been pushing for bold climate action for a long time, and nothing helps them more than having people show up in the streets and giving them the cover they need to push for more aggressive action when their colleagues would shut them down. So as we continue to push our agenda and for an executive that cares about life on Earth, for people and planet, we will continue to support every level of climate champion in the House and the Senate if they show up for everyone. Because at the end of the day, our vision of the future actually saves lives for everyone. It's also nonpartisan. Not dying on a fiery gas ball helps everyone.
Tamara, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your time and insight with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for asking great questions and keeping up the good fight.
My guest has been Tamara Towles O'Loughlin, North America Director of 350.org. We've been discussing the three oil and gas pipeline projects facing major obstacles this week and broader issues linked to it. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.